Welcome to Life, Death, and the Law, presented by the law firm of Deason, Garner, and Hanson, hosted by attorneys Sean Garner and Adam Hanson.
Welcome to another edition of Life, Death, and the Law. I'm Sean Garner in studio here with Adam Hanson, Thomas Sparks, and Cody Beeson. We also have with us a guest, Martin Felix. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So I want to talk this morning about the rise and fall, or mainly the fall of universities. And before I get to that, I want to know about Cody's trip to Maui, because he had to spend 2 weeks in Maui, apparently spending time with his brother's family. And for his sacrifice, he got a nice suntan. And I want to hear how that trip went.
Oh, man. Thank you. I guess, like, you have to take care of, like, teenagers. Like, you have to, there has to be an adult there to take them to school and stuff. I don't know.
How old is this teenager?
15.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So.
Non-driving.
With a permit.
Oh, okay.
Right. And I don't get it, Sean, because when I had a permit, I wanted to drive everywhere.
Yeah.
And I'm like, hey, man, go get your license. You want to drive? No.
Really?
Like, no. He's, like, on a phone the whole time.
Oh,
you know, so it's like that generation.
Cut into his screen time if he had to drive.
Yeah, huh? Exactly. And I'm like, no, I want to be driven around.
You just got to teach him how to drive and scroll at the same time.
Yeah, right. That's an adult. Yeah, it's adult quality.
That's a horrible thing to say.
But
on air.
Yeah, don't do that. But I learned
as you're
get a Tesla,
putting together your phone apparatus that goes on your windshield.
This is an airplane. Oh. This is from my airplane, so you can do that.
Okay. You can text and fly.
Hats off to all you parents, because I don't know how you do it. It seems like every generation is, like, more ungrateful than the last.
I don't know. Yeah, that's true. Like, but next generation is going to have to regress the other way, because it can't get more ungrateful than it is now.
Right. You know, and I get, like, if you're young, you don't want to go through museums, you know, but at some point, like, come on. Come on. I love my family, but... It was fun.
But does he know that he lives in paradise?
He's over it. You know, it's like, hey, let's go, you know, let's go do this thing. Let's go jump, you know, off the cliffs. Eh, I've done that. Eh, whatever. Let's go scuba, you know, snorkeling. Eh, whatever.
So what did you do that was fun?
I mean, we did all that. I forced him to do all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
But he was over it all. Like, he's done it a million times living out there. Like, he'd rather play computer games, you know?
So what was the best thing that you did?
Probably like cliff jumping or the road to Hana.
What's the road to Hana?
It's like a crazy, like, twisty turny road that, we had, like, local. So I had the local experience. Like, I was staying, like, at my brother's house. He was over on the mainland. You know, I was using his Toyota Tacoma, which is, like, the island vehicle there, you know? So I felt like a local. I wasn't a tourist as much of one. So, I mean, I got to, like, experience life on that side of it.
You look Hawaiian.
You know what? I shed some of my oppressive white skin over there.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah.
You're going to have to teach me to be more or less white.
Yeah, just got to go out in the sun without sunblock.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Is that it?
I think so.
Nice.
No shark encounters?
Nothing like that, you know? I was looking for, like, dolphins, because there was a dolphin sighting a couple weeks ago. Like, there's hundreds of them out there. But now we saw turtles and things. But a lot of like, nice wildlife.
It's amazing how much life there is on just the beach of the ocean. I remember when I went to Hawaii a couple of years ago, we were just walking along the beach, and there's crabs and all sorts of things in the sand. You start digging in the sand, and you're going to find a dozen different living things. I didn't realize how much was going on just on the beach part, the sandy beach part of it, and imagine how much more of that is in the ocean. It just blew my mind.
And what's going on, like, right in front of you, right below you when you're swimming? Like, it's all right there within, you know, distance.
Yeah. Well, what, did anything you see scare you a bit?
You know what? It is kind of, I'm not going to lie, like, getting out in the ocean, like, alone, there is something mentally to it that is scary.
It's a little bigger than you.
Yeah, yeah. And when it goes down that far, like, further than you could possibly, like, there's scuba divers below me. I cannot get that far below if I want to dive to the bottom.
Huh.
Kind of scary.
So, yeah, I've experienced the whole, I lived through the teenage years, and of course I was grateful for everything that my parents gave me, but for some reason, they might not remember it that way, but I was. My kids, I seem to be dragging them to everything they go to, and It's like, remember, we decided this together, right? We sat together as a family last night, and we decided this is what you were going to do, and now, like, we're dragging you to it. It's painful. Even getting through the meal, it's like, are you going to finish your meal? Oh, quit bugging me. I'm like, we're just trying to figure out.
Yeah, just trying to feed you, make sure
you're ever going to. Yeah.
My bad.
Exactly.
That's what you're trying too hard. That's the problem.
What do you do?
I just let them fend for themselves.
They're running around like Lord of the Flies out
exactly.
there.
Exactly. It's like, dude, if you don't figure it out, you got a problem when you turn 18.
There's a book on that, Parenting with Love and Logic.
Yeah, Love and Logic. I've gone to those things back in the day when I tried to be a parent before I gave up. After six, it's like, okay, I just hope one makes it. My theory is if they survived 18, you're doing pretty good.
Yeah.
Physically, I'm talking about.
Oh. Yeah, you may have already failed mentally at that point.
Yeah, we got life insurance for all the kids just in case, you know. Mm-hmm.
And there we go. That is the bit too far that we were waiting for.
We're just waiting for that.
I'm not joking about it. It's not a joke. I do life insurance, small little policies. If you don't, I would highly recommend it.
Yeah, well, this is recorded, so when that mysterious event comes up, they might use this against you in a court of law. I want to talk about universities and what's going on with them, but somebody that does it better than I is Victor Davis Hanson. He is one of the most knowledgeable people that I've listened to. He does podcasts all the time. He's right up there with Thomas Sowell. And he teaches at Stanford, and he sees what's going on all around him. He went through the college experience at a very liberal college, but he didn't understand that it was liberal at the time because they weren't openly trying to get a liberal response out of the students. They were teaching them liberal ideals and politics, but they were also teaching them to think analytically. And so he was able to make it through that with some conservative values. But now, it's if you speak up at all with any type of conservative perspective, then they get out, you know, the mob and the pitchforks and the torches, and you're running for your life.
They pull the fire alarm.
They pull the fire alarm on you. Yeah. So let's hear what he has to say. I'm going to cue this up here.
I always used to say that the craziest idea in a faculty lounge takes about 2 years to be implemented in the White House. So it's very influential. There's too many people going to four-year colleges, and they're not learning anything. We have $1.7 trillion in debt, and so the university is very culpable because we have this problem now where we went from 2.1 fertility down to 1.6. It was catastrophic in 25 years. So we've got this whole generation of young people, primarily also male young people, who they're not getting married, they're not buying houses, they're not having children.
Are universities failing students and society? In this video, Victor Davis Hanson discusses the current state of higher education. He argues that universities are churning out graduates burdened with massive debt and insufficient skills, contributing to a national crisis.
And I have them in my own family, and I talk to them. How did you get 150,000 niece or nephew? And the majors that they go 3 units here, 6 units here, 5 units here, and they consume their 20s because of this myth of the four-year degree. And then you have these universities, and you say to them, and I've said this to a lot of administrators, why don't you just tell, you know, when I buy a car, I'm told exactly what the monthly payment is, what the total cost is, and am I aware of all the ins and outs, and I have a 17-page thing to fill out. Would you just tell the student when they take these loans, what is the average compensation of a sociology major, a psych major, a classics major, whatever it is, just tell them how much the interest will cost them and what is the price per unit in dollars. so that they can make a decision and not just fob it off on a guaranteed loan? And then would you also pledge your endowment, get the government out, just pledge it. If you're Stanford University and you have a $40 billion endowment, why don't you just tell the students that they'll have the student loans, but you are on your responsibility when they default? And maybe if that happened, you would offer courses that were relevant, and the students, you would be very critical of the faculty who couldn't teach, etc. And then another thing. Until recently, we had SATs, and the premise of the SAT was the GPA cannot be trusted because there's such a wide disparity in the quality of high school. So an A from my high school, Salma High School, where I graduated, is not really an A compared to Palo Alto High School. And that was true. So therefore, I had to take the SAT. Why don't we have an SAT in the back end? Because I guarantee you that where Stanford is today and watching it, they are not turning students out like Hillsdale College. I teach at both. Yeah. 20 years ago, the Stanford student was far better prepared and educated and came in, not now. And if you had an SAT that said, everybody who needs a BA has to get, I don't know, 85% of 520 on the SAT, you would be surprised how much they hate that idea. And because they don't want any accountability that either they haven't taught people to improve in the skills they said were necessary to take their courses. And I'll just finish this with, I had a guy in Silicon Valley last year. I gave a lecture and he came up to me and I said, at some point their reputations are going to suffer, these four-year colleges, because they're watered down the curriculum and it's DEI. And he said, where have you been, Victor? He said, in the last 3 years, Stanford University let in 20% white students. We don't care what color they are. But to get that ratio, they had to exclude people that were brilliant. So they rejected 70% of those who had a perfect SAT, even though it was it was a choice. They sent it in. And that became a mark of vulnerability. It's like 0.11% of the SAT get perfect scores. Stanford refused 60 or 70% of them that applied. So then he said, and then you have the therapeutic culture. So I said, what are you getting at? He said, when we're in Silicon Valley and we have a choice now in 2023 to hire somebody from Stanford, whether it's public relations or coding or Texas A&M, Georgia Tech, we will take them any day. And I'd say, are you serious? He said, yes, because two things, they're better trained. And the first thing they do not do is go to our HR department and complain. Your students, they're not as competitive. Your faculty, to accommodate the new student body, had to either water down the courses, inflate the grades, but accommodate the fact that they are letting in students by their own admission did not fit the requirements that they used to preach to us were absolutely necessary. Or as he put it, in 1998, these guys would come up to us and say, you know what? It's a very rare person that can get into Stanford University. And once they get in here, we give them the toughest classes. And when we go out to, when they go out there, these guys are brilliant, they're trained. And so then he says to me, well, if that was true, and now they admit that they've thrown out the SAT, then they're admitting they're letting people in that can't do the curriculum on the books that they said was necessary to ensure their prestige. So why would we trust them anymore? And in fact, and that's what's happening to Harvard. 80% of the grades at Yale were A's. So I think what you're saying is, not only is the demographic shrinking, there's fewer students, but the costs are going up above the rate of inflation. The students are not getting any means to pay back the loans, and the universities are no longer meritocratic. And that's even going into medical school, law school, business school. And so a lot of people are saying, I want my child to go get skills. I want him to go to a trade school. I want him to go to a community college. And the elite now, believe it or not, I get a call twice a week, Victor, I'm not going to send my kid to Harvard, Yale, where I went, or Stanford. Is it Hillsdale? Is it Pepperdine? Is it St. Thomas Aquinas? Where do I send my child? Or do I send them to University of Oklahoma, Oklahoma State? And so I'm very confident that there is a revolutionary movement in education to get rid of this toxic, I have a bunch of letters after my name, therefore I'm educated, therefore I'm an expert. And what the universities have done is really, is almost criminal, to put us, the taxpayers, on a $1.7 trillion exposure so they can raise their rates of tuition above the rate of inflation, and they're not accountable, and their students are getting, they're not competitive compared to other universities. The problem is not with the middle and upper middle classes, it's with the credentialed elite, and they, I'm not confident about them, but I think we have to hold them to account in the media and the university especially. But so I think we'll see what happens in November. And, you know, the Republicans have a lot of problems too, but we'll see. It's not so much about Trump or Harris. It's more or less at this, after 233 years, we're not going to call the country a failure, and it's racist, systematically unfair. It's exploitive, and we're going to tear it apart. We're not going to do that. Sorry. If you don't like it, that's the way it's going to be. We're going to vote, and we're not perfect, but we don't have to be perfect to be good, and we're better than the alternative. And for that, that's good enough. And we're going to press on. That's the attitude. And I think it'll prevail.
We have to take a break, but we'll be back to discuss this after this message.
Coming up, more thought-provoking conversations on life, death, and the law right after this.
If you have questions about how to get your affairs in order, we're talking, if you don't have a power of attorney in place or a will in place or some sort of legal planning to plan for the event of when you become incapacitated or you pass away, then you need to come and see us. We've got an upcoming seminar coming on Friday, September 13th. Yes, it's Friday the 13th. Don't be scared. This is the place you want to be. It's at the Foothills Library at 2:30 in the afternoon. Come and see myself and Sean. We'll be there answering questions. There's not very many times that you have available to you to ask questions of an attorney without being billed. This is one of those times. So come and see us. We're going to be talking about how you can put your stuff in order to hopefully avoid government processes if you become incapacitated or when you pass away, to make sure that your assets are protected going to your family members and those that you care about. So come and see us. This is September 13th. It's a Friday. Don't be scared of that. Friday the 13th. Come and see Sean and I, and we'll answer some of your questions.
You're listening to Life, Death, and the Law, presented by Deason, Garner, and Hanson, the law firm that has been voted Yuma's best 6 years in a row.
Welcome back to Life, Death, and the Law. So we just listened to Victor Davis Hanson, and he is a professor at Stanford. He's also a professor at Hillsdale College. So he transfers back and forth and teaches. He does a lot of podcasts on what's going on. He is a professor in classics, Greek literature. But he's got this amazing insight as to what it takes to make the country function. And right now, he's very scared about what's going on with the universities, because they are not only failing the country, but they're failing the students in a large way, because students are acquiring larger and larger amounts of debt that are becoming impossible to pay off, yet their education is becoming more and more worthless. And one of the solutions he gave for that was, instead of the government acting as the guarantor of the student's debt, or even paying off the student's debt and not even requiring the students to try, is that the colleges themselves become the guarantors. And they consider that when they look into what type of degrees they're going to focus and give emphasis to and hire faculty for and put a lot of their funds toward, and what type of students they are bringing on to their campus and admitting to their curriculum. For example, if the college was required to back the student's loan, then, and they look at a bunch of engineers or a bunch of gender study applicants, and they're going to say, who is going to be more able to pay back the loans that we're going to extend to these students to get their education? and make the decisions based on real life decisions instead of just these hypotheticals from their ivory tower.
Yep, I think that's right. I think the only way you fix the system is by giving the university some sort of accountability. That's one way to do it, to be able to make them financially accountable for the charges they make. I think the other thing is just the federal loan system for in general for student loans is messed up. Like anytime you've got like the government subsidizing anything, it usually goes downhill, and they're just subsidizing tuition at this point. I think it needs to go away.
Adam, what's your thoughts?
Well, what would be the alternative then? Go to the private sector?
Mm-hmm.
That's how it was. I mean,
yeah.
And it worked just fine.
Then why did they get involved if it worked just fine?
Because I think they wanted to see numbers go up. They were tired of seeing well-to-do families go to college and then families that didn't have money not go. And then so they said, well, let's fix that number, let's subsidize. And they fixed the number, but then what happened with the quality of the student? It largely dropped. And it's the same thing happened in 2008 with the housing market. They were upset with the demographic of homeowners, so they made it easier to obtain loans to people who couldn't pay back mortgages, and it caused the crash. And I think it's the same thing with the student loan market. It's another bubble that will eventually pop.
You see this over and over again with like welfare programs. The more they up the subsidies, the more they up the entitlements, the worse off the people that they're providing them to become. For example, in the 1960s, African Americans were 80% employed, and they were making, let me start over on that. They made up, man, I'm off on my statistics now, but I believe it was 80% of the income of the national average. Now, that's not great. It's not equal, right? It should be 100% of the national average, but they were rising. And if you looked at what they were from Civil War era, the 100 years prior to that, they had made significant advances between the 1860s and the 1960s. But then these welfare and entitlement systems came in the 1960s, and there was this great reform. And they went from having 80% of the families growing up in two-parent homes to 20 years later, it was only 20% of the families growing up in two-parent homes. The statistics totally flipped. And the disparity in the wage gap actually grew over the next 20 years. And so we see that as the more entitlements and the more subsidies that are provided out there, it actually hurts the groups and the subsets that we're actually trying to help and support.
Yeah, they don't consider the second and third order effects of the programs. And I think the overarching principle is you can't skip steps. You're trying to put somebody who can't afford to pay back what they're doing, and you're skipping them ahead in life and putting them in a financial position they're not naturally supposed to be in. Now, I think there are a lot of pathways to get somebody who can't afford a university degree to eventually get one. You start out in the community college area, you get some classes under your belt, you work for scholarships, and those scholarships used to be more prevalent when people needed them to go to school, but now when everyone knows you can just go get a student loan, they're not as generous with offering grants and scholarships.
And I think that people considered a lot more in depth whether or not it was worth going to school,
mm-hmm.
determining, okay, here's the cost. I'm going to have to work two jobs and go to school, or I'm going to have to save a lot of money working in high school after school to be able to earn tuition. Families sometimes would save all their money to send one child to school at a time. And now it's like, yeah, you go to school. There's debt. Okay, we'll incur it. Mm-hmm. And without really taking into consideration the long-term ramifications of it. And so the less that you think about it in advance and the less sacrifice you put into it, the less serious you take it. And I think that it hurts on both ends. Not only is the education that the person is getting, they're less invested in, but they're less prepared when they come out. They're less educated to actually provide for a living for themselves and a way to repay the debt that they incurred.
And the capitalist idea will fix the high tuition costs as well. Like, people might say, hey, well, no one can afford to go to college without loans anymore. You have to take away the loan to drive tuition down. The universities are in the business of making money at the end of the day. If no one can afford to go to your school because your tuition's too high and the government's not willing to bail the student out, it forces the price down to what the education is actually worth.
Yeah. Look at anything else that the government competes with, for example. My favorite example is always the post office. I see the post office pull up to my house in this raggedy old truck that I would not send my teenager to school in. And I don't know what it is. It's some three-cylinder, like, makeshift conversion of a Jeep. And it's got no AC. It's got a little fan blowing in the window. And the person that steps out is in a regular T-shirt and shorts, stuffing mail in my mailbox, or handing me a box after hours at work. And then I see somebody from Amazon show up in a Rivian truck, you know, that's well uniformed. They're sprinting to the door. They've definitely got a timetable that they're working against. And if there's anything wrong with the package, I let Amazon know, and they're going to get it fixed right away. If I let the post office know that I've got some dilemma with my package, I don't expect them to get right back to me. And so that's the difference between the government subsidizing one service and not the other. Amazon, FedEx, UPS, they figure out a way not only to make it work, but to make it work really well. The more money we pour into, and we pour about $1 billion a month into USPS, into the Postal Service, and look what we get for it. We get terrible service. Same things happen with universities.
Mm-hmm. So how do we break, the question that comes to my mind as you are talking is, how do we break a suspected cycle of impoverishedness in like, not even using the black community, but using, let's say it's a white kid from the hills in Kentucky. You're familiar with that, Sean. You lived in Kentucky. And so they're never on their radar. They've never even contemplated going to school after, even if they graduate from high school. Is there a way, or should there be a way for us to aid that kid in going to school and hopefully breaking this impoverished cycle that's been going on for generations in their family? I guess the question, so that's the question.
Yeah.
Do we even get involved, or you let that naturally play out and just say, some people aren't going to do it?
So here's my response. Today, the means of getting an education is unlimited. I get an education mostly from YouTube, mostly online. It's turning largely now to AI experiences, ChatGPT, and other versions of AI systems. But for example, right now, as we're doing this radio show, I'm seeing you using this micro measurement tool to measure different instruments that you've got that come from your plane. You're 3D printing them. You're working on a highly complex program that you can engineer exactly how you want the instrument panel to work on your airplane. What school did you go to for that?
YouTube
University.
YouTube University, yeah.
Most of the things that you do, you fly an airplane, right? You've got a lot of these different hobbies. You do these things because you set out, you had an ambition to do it, and you follow your passion and your drive and things that you could afford and actually fit within your budget, and you did those. And so that's, I think, the answer. If you go to the Hillsdale site, you can scroll down. Hillsdale College is one of those. It's a private college, and it's an alternative to the Stanfords out there. But what it teaches is a lot about what it means to be a citizen of the United States, what the history of the country and not only the current government is, but where it came from, the Greeks, the Romans, and those other cultures. Because if you don't understand those subcultures, it's going to be very difficult to understand our current culture and the fall, more importantly, of those cultures and how they declined, because then we can see what's going on in our culture to follow the same corrosive paths that there's followed. And you can go down and you can watch all those things for free. I'm enrolled currently in Hillsdale College, and I'm taking a constitutional class online for free. And so a lot of these things don't require any investment of finances. It just requires a willingness to learn. So if you want to learn, you could literally get a Harvard level education in Zimbabwe on a cell phone if you had the willingness to learn. That's what's lacking, is the willingness to actually put in the time and effort. And instead of just accepting a paper that you put on the wall at the end of the day, accepting true knowledge and experience.
So Cody, is that willingness or this drive to better oneself, can that be taught? Can it be incentivized by using free money or loans I'm giving to you? At the end of the day, is a person just the way that they are? Like, they're either going to be motivated or not? That's the question.
Well, I mean, I think people have to want to have that education, right? So some people are going to understand that, and they're going to want to have, you know, the quality education, whether it comes from a traditional university or these newer ones. I think the proof is, look at the Hillsdales, look at the Peterson Academy that's being developed, and the PragerU's, and there's more of these opportunities for people to get, I don't know if I want to say unbiased, but an unbiased education, and a very affordable, you know,
because
the market's turning there.
Yeah. And let's talk about some of those that you just brought up. PragerU, for example,
yeah.
They allow anybody to come on and discuss points and have interviews and debate their issues. It's not limited to a certain political viewpoint. And that's the difference. There was this video that played before with Victor Davis Hanson that says, if he got up in his class and said, here's my viewpoint, Jesus Christ is the savior of the world, and if you don't accept him, then you will not have redemption. He said, if I said that, I'd be chased out of the university, maybe not quite literally, but figuratively, he would be brought, he would be reported, and he would probably be dismissed. But if he said that we're going through a global warming experience that is man-made, and unless we do something right now that is extreme and take this on and stop the production of fossil fuels and the burning of all the carbon-emitting fuels, then we are all going to die in a matter of a decade. And if you even put that timeline on, a decade, then not only would he be accepted, he'd be applauded. Now, if he changed that narrative a little bit and said, I really don't think there's much we can do about the warming of the earth that's occurring. I don't think it's occurring as drastically, and I don't think that the natural disasters are as exaggerated as they seem on the media. If he said that, then again, he's going to be silenced. He's going to be canceled. He's going to be reprimanded. So there isn't this open discourse, which is absolutely necessary, and that's why that's the underpinning of a free society, is free speech. And because we don't have that natural discourse, we can't have a good, solid education. We've got to take a break. We'll be back after these messages.
Coming up, more thought-provoking conversations on life, death, and the law right after this.
Hey, Yuma, Dave Ramsey here. If you listen to our show or know anything about us, then you know I only recommend products and services I trust and I believe in. That's why when it comes to protecting your assets and planning for your loved one's future, you've got to call my friends Sean Garner and Adam Hansen at the law firm of Deason, Garner, and Hansen. I encourage you to take the first step and attend a free, no-pressure seminar and learn all of your options. The firm of Deason, Garner, and Hansen has been educating the Yuma community for over 40 years, and this is the only area of law that they practice. Sean and Adam believe in giving free education to help people make smart decisions about their assets and help them leave a legacy for their family that they can be proud of. Schedule a free personal consultation today. Call 783-4575 or visit YumaEstatePlanning.com.
You're listening to Life, Death, and the Law, presented by Deason, Garner, and Hanson, the law firm that has been voted Yuma's best 6 years in a row.
Welcome back to Life, Death, and the Law. So I've got this old John Stossel interview that he did, or reporting that he put on. It looks like it's about 20 years old, but it is just as relevant today as ever. And it's talking about the dichotomy between two Indian tribes, one that has gotten billions of dollars of subsidies from the U.S. government, and another that has not been recognized as a Native American tribe and therefore has not gotten subsidies, and how they have fared over their time. So I'm going to play this clip for you.
Has been helped more by government than American Indians. And yet, some politicians still tell Indians things like this.
Few have been ignored by Washington for as long as Native Americans.
Ignored? Are you kidding me? Look at the signs around this Sioux Reservation in South Dakota. Our government has made Indian tribes wards of our state. Government manages their land, provides their health care, their schools, gives them food stamps, pays for housing, child care, even burial assistance. The result?
There is a stunning poverty here. Only one in four has a job. There is a scarcity of phones, not even any banks.
Indians have the highest poverty rate and lowest life expectancy of any group in America. So the Sioux told us they need more handouts.
The government should be giving the Indian people more appropriations to so that we could exist out here still.
I really feel Obama's administration needs to get up to the plate and deal with this.
Because white people stole the Indians' land hundreds of years ago, the government signed treaties. And that's why Washington sends billions of dollars to Indian tribes every year.
Everybody thinks the government owes them something.
It's odd in that no group has been more helped by government than the American Indians, and no group does worse.
Maybe it's the government.
Ben Chavis is a member of a tribe that doesn't get special government help. And yet,
the area where you live looks different from Indian reservations.
There's mansions. They look like English manors. I can take you to one neighborhood where my people are from and show you nicer homes than a whole Sioux reservation.
And this is not casino money, no special deal for your tribe.
Oh, no. In my tribe, we don't have any casinos. We have 12 banks.
Chavis says his tribe does well because the federal government does not recognize them as a sovereign tribe, though their congressman wants to change that.
It's time for discrimination to end and recognition to begin.
Old Mike knows if he wants to stay in Washington, D.C., he has to support the Lumbees or he won't be there.
This is an injustice that, yes, must finally be resolved.
If the congressman gets his way, your tribe will just get $80 million. It's tough to say no to that.
If you want to become dependent on the government and sell your soul for $80 million, I understand that. And some people are willing to do that.
Indian activists like lawyer Elizabeth Homer say the Lumbees ought to get federal recognition. Homer used to be the U.S. Interior Department's Director of American Indian Trusts.
Well, the Lumbees have been neglected and left out of the system and have been petitioning for 100 years for their recognition, for which they're entitled, by the way.
They're petitioning because socialists like you have convinced them to do that.
Oh, I'm a socialist now.
They do better without the government.
If I'm a socialist, what does that make you?
Bye.
It makes me and Ben Chavis capitalists. And capitalist Indians achieve.
Your Indians are thriving.
Our Indians are working.
The Scott brothers built a company that now employs 16 people, putting up power lines. They didn't get any government help.
It made me drive twice as hard, you know, knowing that he wouldn't help us and all. It panned out pretty good for us.
We've just been always been hard workers.
So that's what that is.
This Lumbee tribe member, Lindsay Locklear, runs one of the biggest True Value hardware stores in the country.
The day after I graduated, the next day I was at work.
The Lumbees are doing well.
Tremendous survivors. A great example of how you can continue to persist under absolutely the worst treatment that you could hope to get.
They do well because they've divorced themselves from these government handouts. They've done well.
Individuals have done well.
Exactly.
Individuals free of special government protection, like Lumbee Jim Thomas, a real estate developer who used to own the Sacramento Kings. Jack Lowry, an original owner of the Cracker Barrel restaurants. Or Sybil Bullard, who owns J.R. Jones Grain.
We had to fend for ourselves. We had to do what we needed to do to survive. We don't mind getting our hands dirty and getting the job done because we know that if we do, we will be rewarded for that.
What helped the Lumbees, said Ben, was knowing that they had to become entrepreneurs and support themselves.
On the reservations, they haven't trained to be capitalists. They've been trained to be communists. Everything you need someone's approval.
Tribal governments and the Bureau of Indian Affairs manage most Indian land in America. Indians often compete to serve on tribal councils because then they can give out the government's money.
You can help your relatives. You can help your girlfriend. You can help your girlfriend's mama. It's a great program.
Not so great for the majority of Indians. Because the government owns most Indian property, individuals rarely build nice homes or businesses.
No individual on the reservation owns the land, so they can't do anything with it. They can't develop it. Let's look at my tribe. We have title and deeds to our land. That's the secret. I raise cattle, Red Angus cattle. I can do what I want to because it's my private property. My buddy on the White Mountain Apache Reservation, he has a farm, but he can't do the same things I can do. If the tribe decided one day, we want to take your land on the reservation and give it to one of my relatives, they could do that.
Government handouts don't work well even for the freeloaders. But there are always enablers who say, yes, they will.
American Indians own more land than any group in America, and you are still the poorest group. How can that be?
Indian reservations are basically in areas that have been neglected by the United States. The tribes have been located in some of the most isolated areas geographically.
So what? Other isolated groups have done well.
How come the Mormons got rich? Where they lived, it's just as poor. How come the Amish got wealthy, even rejecting modern tools?
I don't know how wealthy the Amish are, and I don't know how the Mormons got rich.
Maybe because they weren't relying on government rules and Indian trusts and all your lawyering that teaches Indians to be helpless?
Oh my goodness, I don't think that that's true at all. I take umbrage at that, sir.
What you're really saying is Indians are too dumb to manage their own land, so the government has to be, you know, papa and take care of us. We don't need the government giving us handouts.
There is no Bureau of Irish Affairs or Latino Affairs. Why is there a Bureau of Indian Affairs?
We are a starved people in a rich nation.
Already we've got the Empowering Tribal Nations Initiative, the Advancing Nation-to-Nation Relationships, Protecting Indian Country, Tribal Priority Allocations, Indian Land Consolidation Program. All these government programs. Indians are poor.
Indians are poor.
Die young.
And that's why these programs are so important.
But maybe these programs are why Indians are poor.
Well, I don't think that that's a fair thing to say. In fact, I think that they are the most neglected of any population
government
in the United States.
Government needs to do more.
Yeah.
And every freeloader wants more.
We get welfare checks, we get grant checks, we get food stamps, but if you look at these farmers and ranchers, they get the same thing. That's what these subsidy payments are for.
It is true that subsidies also go to farmers and ranchers and big companies. But just like the gifts given these people, subsidies keep you dependent. The handouts certainly haven't helped America's Indians.
What do you think about that, Cody?
I think it's right. I mean, look at what we're dealing with. I mean, look, I know people that get free housing and they can't work. Not that they can't work, they don't work because they wouldn't have their housing.
I was just out at the Kokopo Indian Reservation not too long ago, and it was as if I crossed the border, not to Mexico, but to some other starved third world country. And I don't mean to disrespect the Kokopo tribe, but what has gone on is disgraceful for that people, because nothing is improved. It's true. The land there is not improved. All the houses, it looks like they were built in the 1960s. And then other than some newer model cars that are in the driveway, they've been stuck in this time lapse that everything has just fallen down around them. There's nothing, there's no lawns, there's no fences, there's no, improvements that indicates that the people that live there are taking care of the residences that they live in.
Well, I mean, they're not. It's not their homes. It's homes of the tribe. So it's basically like an apartment complex.
And the concept is if they received these homes and they don't have the other burdens of having to save for education and having to work to make sure that they can pay for groceries, they would have more leisure time to take care of the property and to have a higher quality of life. But it's the complete opposite.
Yeah, you need skin in the game, you know, to be able to, I think, make any meaningful improvements. If you've got everything, nothing is yours, and it doesn't change no matter what you do or don't do, you're going to choose to not do anything. And I think the free handouts are responsible for robbing people of their ambition. And when you can get something for free, you're not motivated to do something better because it's going to come either way.
I'm often hired as a lawyer. I do Medicaid applications to help people get government assistance because nursing homes are so expensive that many people, they can't afford them, and they need this extensive care. So I would say an average cost of a nursing home is about $8,000 a month here in Yuma. And for an individual to qualify, they can't have any more than $2,000 of assets or countable assets, and they can't make more than $2,800 a month. So when I go to Indian tribes, they get paid annually, typically, from the tribe, and let's say that their payment is $10,000. They'll get that in a lump sum payment, and so they'll get cut off of their benefits. So my job is to help them either invest or use that money in a way that will quickly deplete their bank account in order for them to continue their Medicaid benefits. As an attorney, my job is to work through the legal system. It feels counterintuitive, and I don't know of an alternative, but I'm working in a broken system. But it breaks my heart to see that the more handouts or benefits that they receive, the more quickly we've got to spend it and get rid of it so we can receive a greater benefit through consistent $8,000 checks to nursing homes or long-term care assistance. And unfortunately, a lot of the individuals, they're far too young to be needing these types of services. They're in their 60s as opposed to their 80s. And that is distressing too.
So what's this? We had this conversation years ago, Sean, about public assistance in general. And so I had the thought come to mind, well, has Sean changed his mind on that? I think when we had that conversation, this was years ago, we probably don't remember it. But in that conversation, we were talking about food stamps. Mm-hmm. And how you thought it was necessary that we should, as a society, provide some sort of social welfare to a certain extent. Do you still stand by that, or is it more like, no, everybody just needs to buck up?
Well, I think that there is so much wealth in our nation that children don't need to go to bed hungry. So to that extent, yes, I think that there needs to be a safety net out there, that we need to have... WIC is a wonderful program. That's women, infants, and children, where they get certain food stamps, if you will, that they can buy the staples, bread, milk, potatoes.
Alcohol.
No.
Oh, cigs.
Can't do that.
So it doesn't work.
You can now, can't you?
It doesn't work at Circle K. You know, it mm-hmm. doesn't work at McDonald's. You go to grocery stores, and there are certain brands of food that have... that meet the nutrient levels that are required for the
voucher
and for the program to actually provide nourishment for the individuals. But they're not going home with T-bone steaks on this program, on WIC. But with the food stamp program, it's like a credit card. So number one, it's really easy to use, and it's incognito. So nobody knows that you're actually using, it's called EBT, food stamps when you swipe the credit card, and you can get basically anything at Circle K other than alcohol, cigarettes, tobacco. And that is not going to lead to a very healthy lifestyle when you're living off of gas station food. The other thing is you get much more than you need. And I have been on food stamps. So when I went through college, I was working, but I had a family of two children and a wife, and I didn't make enough So we applied for food stamps and we got those. And when we got them, we were blown away because normally our grocery bill before we were getting food stamps was maybe $100, $150 a month. And we got $400, $500 a month in food stamps. We didn't know what to do with it all. We could not spend it all. If we bought the most expensive luxury food that we wanted, we couldn't spend it all. And that's the problem, is it's so overboard and so packed with pork that nobody would want to get off the system. And so there's no incentive to get off the system.
Yeah, I think in theory it works, that in theory we could have a safety net and the government could do it, but in reality and in practice it never does because of the human factor. You know, people don't want to get off it when they should, or there's special interest groups that want to help these types of people. They put pork in the bills. And I think, from my take, the way to fix that is by moving the charitable resources back to the private sector, back to private charity, and away from the public sector. And that's, I wish it wasn't that way, but I think it would have to go that way in order for it to actually work.
What's your take on that, Cody?
We've seen where these, I agree with you, the WIC program is essential, right? It helps people that need it. But I wish there weren't the requirement that you have to be like a single mother to have that, right? And I'm not part of that. I don't know anything about it.
And you don't have to be a single mother.
You don't?
No, I've been on, not personally, my wife was on WIC.
Okay, so, and I'm just talking out my neck that I don't know what I'm talking about. So I thought you couldn't have a two-parent household and still get those benefits.
No, it's men of working age don't get it.
Oh, okay.
Okay, but women that have children do get it.
Because
even if they're married.
I thought at some point that we changed in the system that we went away from having a two-parent household. Like
there is greater incentives,
yeah,
and a larger portion of food stamps go out to individuals that don't have men of working age in the household, or you're married to a man. And I don't know the exact breakdowns of that, but I know that I didn't qualify for WIC. That my wife and my children did. And the point I'm making is it's got to be a standard of living that is subsistent, but not nearly to the level of somebody that actually contributes to society. Yeah. That's all the time that we have for today. This is Life, Death, and the Law.
If you have questions or want to know more about something that was discussed today, please call the law firm of Deason, Garner & Hanson at 928-783-4575 or visit YumaEstatePlanning.com.
If you have questions about how to get your affairs in order, we're talking if you don't have a power of attorney in place or a will in place or some sort of legal planning to plan for the event of when you become incapacitated or you pass away, then you need to come and see us. We've got an upcoming seminar coming on Friday, September 13th. Yes, it's Friday the 13th. Don't be scared. This is the place you want to be. It's at the Foothills Library at 2:30 in the afternoon. Come and see myself and Sean. We'll be there answering questions. There's not very many times that you have available to you to ask questions of an attorney without being billed. This is one of those times. So come and see us. We're going to be talking about how you can put your stuff in order to hopefully avoid government processes if you become incapacitated or when you pass away, to make sure that your assets are protected going to your family members and those that you care about. So come and see us. This is September 13th. It's a Friday. Don't be scared of that. Friday the 13th. Come and see Sean and I, and we'll answer some of your questions.